so few of us left active, healthy, and without personality disorders.
Change has come to America.
The truth out there.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
Highly funded yet unofficial government agency.
I've now been in 57 states.
Who watches the Watchers or the Watchmen? I'm Derek Gilbert. Welcome to PID Radio. Sharon is hard at work this evening working on new website designs for our site. So she is downstairs coding and doing graphic work. And that leaves me the enjoyable task of welcoming back to PID Radio one of our favorite guests, and a very timely guest, too, I think, Taylor Kent, a.k.a. the Snarky Avenger. Taylor, welcome back to PID Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's been a while, and I'm glad to be back.
Well, the last time we talked was a year ago after you graciously invited me and paid my way into the excellent MoCon hosted by Maurice Broaddus just up the road in Indianapolis, where we got a chance to meet a variety of fascinating people involved in speculative and genre fiction. But you're also heavily involved, I guess that's fair to say, in the, no, maybe not heavily involved, but you've been a longtime fan of comics, graphic novels, and so forth. And, of course, as you well know, the probably the most influential or one of the most influential graphic novels of the last 25 years finally made it to the big screen last week. 3609. We'll just avoid or ignore the numerology there. 3609, Watchmen, written by Alan Moore, was turned into a major motion picture.
Right.
And over the past week, Sharon and I had the opportunity to watch the graphic novel come to life, what they call a motion comic, which is available as an online, on-demand choice from our cable company. Essentially, it is the graphic novel, just with a minimum of animation and an excellent narration provided by the actor Tom Steckschulte, who's kind of made a career as a reading audiobooks and does a wonderful job.
Okay, cool.
But as we watch this film, Watchmen, and again, we've not seen the live-action film that is in the theaters now. We've seen the actual animation of the actual book on which the film is based.
Right.
It really hit us that this was really a dark view of the world. And this is not the first work from Alan Moore, the author of Watchmen, that has that kind of worldview. And it started me to thinking about the influence on my own beliefs of all the comic books that I read when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I was a kid, I had two older cousins who, once they got old enough to discover girls, handed off all of their Marvel comics to me. And I had, at one time, I had in my possession some very early editions of Spider-Man, X-Men, Daredevil, The Avengers, The Fantastic Four, Silver Surfer, Submariner, you know, Thor, just every one of the Incredible Hulk, all of the major Marvel characters.
Right.
And my parents let me read them all. They didn't think anything about it. But as I started to think about the underlying theme of Watchmen and then other graphic novels that have some of which have been turned into major motion pictures and started comparing that to what I remember from some of the books that I read when I was 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, it occurred to me that there are a lot of messages being presented to kids through these graphic novels and comic books that parents really don't know about, think about, or are even aware that they exist. Is that a fair – am I being paranoid here?
Well, no. I don't think you're being any more paranoid than we should be with any of the material that we allow both ourselves and our children to pay attention to, whether that be TV, books, comic books, movies. It just happens that a lot of comic books – have a greater, and I don't know how, you know, to be honest, I pick up my comics every week and I don't know how great the appeal is for comic or for kids anymore with a lot of it because, you know, I'm in the comic book store weekly or biweekly to pick up books and you don't see a lot of kids anymore, but you see a lot of people who probably love them as kids. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that you really see them on racks at stores anymore. I don't think you see them much in bookstores. So I wonder if they have as big an influence on kids anymore, like they did when we were kids. Obviously, I remember going to the 7-Eleven and you'd pick up the random issue of Fantastic Four or Thor or whatever, you know, happened to be there before I got into collecting, more or less.
It's interesting. The grocery stores, the local grocery stores, locally owned grocery stores in Columbia, Missouri, which of course is a college town, had racks devoted to comic books and graphic novels. And I don't see that here in Shelbyville. Maybe the presence of the large 18 to 22 year old community here had something to do with it. But the reason, and I think you're right about that. I don't see kids who are presented with the option today of reading a comic book versus playing Xbox or Nintendo, which is another whole discussion to have, the message that they're getting from those video games.
Right.
I think very often we'll choose the video game over the comic or the graphic novel. We didn't have that choice back in the day.
Right.
But and part of what started me down this road, too, was discussing with our 19-year-old daughter, Watchmen. And she is a huge fan of Watchmen ever since she first discovered it. Now, Watchmen has been out since 1987 or 88, I believe. So this
sounds right. Yeah.
This has been out for over 20 years, and it's only just now making it to the movie screens. But she raves about it, says it's the best graphic novel ever. In fact, Time magazine ranked Watchmen among its 100 best novels of all time. Not graphic novels, novels, period, of all time. So this shows that this has a little more influence than your typical graphic novel. And Alan Moore, the author of Watchmen, is considered to be, and I will quote from one of his reviewers, the high priest of the comics industry, the high priest of the graphic novel industry. He's also responsible for From Hell, which was turned into a movie with Johnny Depp, V for Vendetta, which of course starred Hugo Weaving, the guy in the mask, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which was a disappointing movie with Sean Connery. He also created the character Constantine, which was a movie starring Keanu Reeves. Now, for those not familiar with Watchmen and why I'm focusing on this, just a brief synopsis of the plot. It essentially takes place in an alternate history in which Richard Nixon was still the president in 1985. It's set in 1985. Richard Nixon is still the president. Constitution's been changed. And Watergate never happened because of the intervention of one of the costumed heroes.
And you're at 2 minutes to midnight on the nuclear clock.
2 minutes to midnight on the nuclear clock, and war with Russia appears imminent. The only thing keeping Russia at bay is one of the superheroes who is a product of an atomic mutation, a character called Dr. Manhattan. Make a long story short, what the plot finally boils down to is this. One of these costumed heroes takes it upon himself to create a false flag terror event, something we talked about on PID Radio many times, except this one is to be blamed on an alien from outer space. And he goes to the trouble of creating a plausible extraterrestrial responsible for the deaths of about 4 million people in New York City. New York City is devastated. And the costumed heroes who remain find out about this, but decide, except for one, to go along with it because the world unites against this perceived threat and thus averts a nuclear holocaust of our own making. The one character who disagrees and thinks this is an evil act that needs to be exposed is killed to prevent him from talking. It's a very bleak, depressing, dark story. The world is presented in very brutal terms. It's all self-centered, violent, sexually oriented. It's not the kind of place where anyone in their right mind would want to live. And frankly, if you're looking at the world that we live in, the real world, with the eyes of a Christian, you'd say, you know what, living in a world that is under the domain of the enemy, Satan and the fallen angels, we essentially live in a world that's under the control of psychotic mass murderers. In essence. The difference is that as Christians, we have a way out. We have a lifeboat. Alan Moore in Watchmen presents no such lifeboat. essentially the only way out is through an act of murder of 3-4 million people, which, interestingly, is also the same solution he poses to the fascist government in V for Vendetta,
mm-hmm.
an act of yep. mass murder. And in another one of Alan Moore's works, Miracle Man, it's essentially the same solution in which the superheroes gather together and set themselves up as gods over the rest of us mortals mm-hmm. for our own good. It's a godless world that Moore presents. It is a world that is depressing and in which, to borrow a phrase from the Bible, every man does what's right in his own eyes, because there is no right. God. There is no ultimate arbiter of good and evil, right and wrong. And that is the message that you take away from Watchmen, at least the graphic novel. Now, I don't know how that's been changed for the movie. Right. Obviously, the movie is going to have to be condensed or you get a 6-hour film.
Right.
So, with that as the backdrop, and Alan Moore being arguably the most influential author of these graphic novels out there, what message, Taylor Kent, are the readers of graphic novels as a whole, not just Alan Moore's works, what sort of message do you see in the books that you pick up on a weekly basis? Is this the message that kids or adults, whoever's reading these, is this the message that they're getting?
You know, it varies a lot. You know, Alan Moore is no longer mainstream. The mainstream books, such as Marvel and DC, still are very humanist in what they present. You know, superheroes are going to save the world. They have the powers to do it, to help the common man. Very rarely do you even see the mention or the appearance of anything faith or religion based. As a positive or even just as a neutral factor. Mm-hmm. The less mainstream books, it's a little more mixed. And Alan Moore, although, you know, he is considered by some the high priest of great comics and has kind of left some people in his wake, like Garth Ennis and Warren Ellis, who have also created some incredible stuff, who are in, yeah, I guess, similarly, their stuff is very dark, but they have some different takes on how religion plays into things. But for the mainstream reader, you're going to get a fairly secularist message saying, you know, basically, we're going to do whatever we're going to do and save ourselves kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And if you look at some of Moore's later work, by the way, Moore claims to be a magician,
right?
In terms of his beliefs, so he at least believes in the supernatural to some degree.
In fact, he quotes it, and this is a direct quote from Alan Moore. By the way, he says, "It's frightening. You call out the names in this strange, incomprehensible language, and you're looking into the glass, and there appears to be this little man talking to you. It just works." So when Taylor says he claims to be a magician, he really believes that he is a ceremonial magician.
Right.
And he may well be.
So. Well, yeah. I mean, I've never met the guy, I can't say, but, you know, I believe he is. I mean, mm-hmm. it underscores some of the work he's done, such as the Hellblazer stuff
with Constantine.
Well, Hellblazer was the original comic.
Mm-hmm.
Which was predicated on one idea, and I love to throw this out because I think it's just a cool idea, way to come up with an idea for a story, and that was, what if Sting were a parapsychologist?
Mm-hmm.
Which is why in the book, or the comic book, the character looks like Sting, not Keanu Reeves.
Right. And that is brilliant, because Sting looks, he definitely has his own look. I mean, as Fade Rotha in the original Dune, mm-hmm. he was creepy. There's no question. But even in the mainstream comics, you do get a twist of theology. I mean, Thor is part of the Norse cosmology.
Right.
And you do get elements of the supernatural in a lot of these comic books. Silver Surfer is very metaphysical.
Right. Well, that's true. I mean, you have things like Doctor Strange where it's very supernatural and he's using the powers from beyond. But that's usually, you know, there's never, at least anything I've seen from the mainstream comics, there's never an overarching authority such as God who controls everything. It's more like these different pantheons exist and they're fighting it out amongst themselves.
which
you've
is,
got the Norse pantheon, you've got, you know, the new gods in the DC universe, and you've got all the various creatures and gods that exist throughout the different dimensions that play into the Doctor Strange stuff, you know, plus aliens, plus everything else.
But that in itself is a pantheon of sorts. In
right.
That, the message is presented to kids that, yeah, the supernatural exists, but there is no most high god. There are these other lesser gods, which are very often archetypes of the fallen angels that we've talked about here on PID Radio many times.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I mean, in essence, the way the most comics are set up, I mean, you know, and they're, let's face it, they're set up to be a fun, adventurous story. Mm-hmm. But it always comes down to the average people are being defended, taken care of by people who have these superpowers, whether they be supernatural in origin, alien in origin, technological in origin. They are always basically at the mercy of super beings. Mm-hmm. So in essence, you know, if you really look at the heart of where comics go, and that's not to say that, you know, average people aren't important in comics and all that, but we're kind of pawns in this game of supers when it comes down to it. Mm-hmm. There isn't a lot of, you know, more often than not when you're reading it, it's mostly supers versus supers. You don't get a lot of influence from, you know, a lot of influence in terms of average people. I mean, they're there because they play a role, but they're not, very rarely are they main characters, at least in the mainstream stuff.
So again, the stuff of Moore, who is an eccentric, and maybe that's partly his worldview takes him out of the mainstream. You know, the fact
right.
that he's a ceremonial magician and has some odd personal views of the world is part of it. Also, the fact that he's got a reputation of being somewhat difficult to get along with.
Right.
means that some of the bigger companies just don't want to work with him. And conversely, he doesn't want to work with them. But so you're saying then that guys like Moore and those that put forward a worldview like that don't have as much influence as just a flat humanist view that's presented throughout the mainstream comics.
That's been my experience.
Okay.
You tend to see a much more humanist approach in the mainstream superhero type comics. You know, we're basically talking about super beings who are godlike, who are taking care of people, and, you know, whether they be products of aliens or whatever. Very rare, outside of comics that are specifically Christian, I don't think I've ever heard of a superhero whose powers were, where the origin of his powers were, I was given this power by God. Mm-hmm. To do these things, or, you know, maybe by a god, but not, you know, that would be one of many, you know, like Thor with the hammer that was, you know, it's the whole Norse thing. Mm-hmm. There are the other Norse gods play into the Marvel pantheon, as it were. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in essence, the way Marvel treats them, though, they are really nothing more than other super beings. Yeah, they live in their own dimension. Yeah, they have powers that in some cases are greater than many super beings, but they're really nothing more than that. Mm-hmm. And that's how they treat. That seems to be, at least from my experience, how they treat most of the mainstream characters, you know, and in when they get into deity and everything else. It's, well, yeah, they exist. Most, whatever pantheon they choose to play around with, Marvel chose to bring the Norse pantheon in. I don't remember. I know DC has done that with some of their stuff too, and I don't remember who they've brought into their universe. But again, they just become part, you know, they're more super beings. It's pretty humanist when it comes right down to it, you know, and it's pretty, if you take it to the extreme that I've always wanted to see done, and it's probably been done and I haven't seen it, ultimately you're saying that these people have power, so they would be better off running the world. So, you know, where's the council of super beings who runs everything, mm-hmm. right? So.
Well, and now getting back to Watchmen and the view of the world that's presented in Watchmen, and again, I'm talking about the graphic novel, not the film, which I have
right.
not seen. The a number of characters, several of the characters, express the opinion that there is no God. Rorschach right. says we are all alone in the dark. There is no one else. The being that is closest, the character that's closest to a godlike creature, Dr. Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
who has the ability to essentially
manipulate matter at the subatomic level,
manipulate time and matter,
yeah.
Says that he doesn't think there's a God. And in fact, his reaction to the character Ozymandias, who creates this catastrophe in New York City, mm-hmm. is one of detached interest, basically. Like,
right.
Well, you know, he's right. He has prevented a nuclear holocaust by killing 4 million people, so we can't say anything about it. And as for me, I'm going to go off to another galaxy that's less complicated. Human life is interesting. I think I'll create some, is essentially the way he puts it.
Right.
And the other masked adventurers in the story, the so-called heroes, agree to go along with it, with the exception, of course, of the character Rorschach, who is pretty clearly psychotic by the
right.
You know, but you know, you begin to understand his response to evil is to go to bars on the wrong side of town and break fingers until somebody talks and tells him what he wants to know.
Right.
So no one in this book is likable, and yet I mean there is not a single sympathetic character in the entire book as far as I can see, and yet it has become. It is the book that cemented Alan Moore's reputation as the most influential, the seminal figure in graphic novels. The worldview seems to be echoed in the work of Frank Miller when you look at Sin City.
And, right.
Now, Sin City, I've only seen the film. I've not read the actual novel. Again, it's critically acclaimed. It made a lot of money both as a novel and as a major motion picture. Of course, it also helped him get 300 made.
Right.
But the view in Sin City is oppressively bleak, where,
right.
you know, again, there's really nothing in the world that recommends it as a place that any rational person would want to live.
Well,
what is the influence of the book on people like this? What sort of response does it evoke in the people who read books like this that are just violent, dark, depressing? There is no hope. All you can do is try to make the best mark you can before you check out. In other words, life, life's, you know, stinks and then you die.
Right. Well, I think to some degree, I mean, I was into comics in the 80s. And I remember when Watchmen appeared as its original issues, mm-hmm. and read them then. Comics really, there was a shift that took place then in a lot of respects. Watchmen not only changed, you know, it kind of set Alan Moore up as this incredible writer when it came to comic books, but it also changed the tone in a lot of comic books. You saw, I mean, you always had some degree of anti-heroes floating around, mm-hmm. but it seemed that anti-heroes became more the norm. And, you know, everything goes in cycles. We see, you know, somebody comes up with this great idea and you see it kind of ripple through everything. You see everything get darker. Frank Miller was writing comics long before Watchmen came out. You know, Daredevil 181 is probably his seminal work with Daredevil and the Elektra saga, mm-hmm. The original Elektra saga. Which has been retold over and over and over and badly every time. And it gave us two bad movies, but we won't get that far into that. Uh-huh. And Frank Miller's work has always been more on the violent side. I didn't actually read the Sin City stuff. I've seen parts of the movie. It didn't really interest me all that much. Mm-hmm. You know, to be honest, when I pick up a comic book, I generally either pick up horror books because I happen to like horror, or if I'm looking at a superhero comic book or something like that, I'd like to have a hero I can believe in who's actually doing something that's worth doing. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of what Miller's later work went on to do was create these horrible people who might in the end do something that's ultimately good. But you're like, well, why would I want to believe in this person in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah.
With the characters of in the Sin City books and some of his other work. You know, he also wrote one of the RoboCop movies, but we won't hold that against him. You know, and I agree. The Watchmen is the same kind of thing. And if you look at V for Vendetta, there's a lot of the same themes running through there. You know, obviously Alan Moore doesn't trust government. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he looks at these super beings and the way they're, you know, perceived in the book or created in the book in Watchmen is, well, yeah, they're all kind of scumbags who, well, not, you know, they're the heroes of the time, but at the same time, you're seeing the real side of them. You're seeing their willingness to do things for the, what they consider the greater good. Mm-hmm. You know, whether we would consider it the greater good is another story. You know, how many people, this is that freedom versus security argument that always comes up. How many people would, if they found out that that had gone on and found out that it averted a nuclear war, would ultimately come down to it and say, well, they did the right thing by being complicit in this. Mm-hmm. You know,
killing 4 million people in order to save 4 billion, which was the population at the time. I know we're up to 6 million right now, but
good of the many versus good of the few, right?
Sure. It's an order out of chaos thing.
Right.
V for Vendetta, Watchmen, same situation in which the protagonists opt for deconstructing, demolishing society as it exists mm-hmm. in order to create something new. And that may have something to do with his own background and not being intimately familiar with what Alan Moore believes.
Right.
I'm just speculating. The whole order out of chaos thing is certainly a... again, topic for a whole nother show.
Right.
But the so who are the people that you see as the target audience for these graphic novels? If it isn't kids anymore, at least as far as the graphic novels go, certainly the movies appear to be aimed at that segment of the populace.
Right. Well, to some degree. I mean, obviously Watchmen isn't aimed at kids per se. Teenagers to some degree. I think it's got an R rating, which will only make it more appealing to teenagers.
Sure.
I haven't seen the film yet either, so I can't speak to that. Well, considering the dismalness of our times, I think there's something to people want to go and, well, you know, be entertained by darkness, I guess. I don't know. The people I see buying the books who I know and buy books are people like me in their 30s and 40s, you know, 20s to 40s, mm-hmm. Who buy a grand variety of things. I know for a lot of people, it's just, it's their equivalent. It's some form of entertainment for them. Mm-hmm. And the people who buy the mainstream books, I think that's even more so. I mean, this is their weekly, hey, I'm going to go read my comics and enjoy them kind of thing. It's my escape into this fantasy world where good more often than not trumps evil, even though we've seen, you know, with the recent death of Captain America and some of the other greats of the comic book world in terms of characters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we killed Superman off in the 90s mm-hmm. for, you know, but I don't think mainstream. I also don't think that many of these books are as approachable at the same younger ages that, say, the older books were. They're more complex. They deal with, to some degree, they deal with more complex issues as comics have tried to stay more relevant. I mean, there was a huge influx in the 80s of third-party publishers or these small imprints that came up. Mm-hmm. Image Comics is still around. There were a couple that were really good and, you know, kind of taking away from the mainstream, showing that there was more that could be done with comics than just, X-Men and Fantastic Four and Batman and Superman. And you've seen changes. I think a lot of that came about, well, you know, Watchmen came during that time frame, mm-hmm. but you've seen changes where comics have gotten darker because I think they're trying to be more reflective of how the authors and writers and editors perceive the world mm-hmm. And perceive their characters. I mean, if you look at it, Batman is a very dark character. Batman and Rorschach aren't that different in a lot of respects.
Well, no. And in fact, in Watchmen, if you think about it, all of the superheroes are either, you know, well, superhero may be a misnomer. In fact, he really never uses the phrase superhero in the book. They're
right.
all masked adventurers or
right.
masked vigilantes from the viewpoint of the police in Watchmen.
Right.
The only character with superhuman powers is Dr. Manhattan, who was exposed to radiation, which changed him at the atomic level.
Right.
All the others are just either psychopaths like Rorschach or bored rich people.
Yeah, for the most part.
Rich
right.
guys who are bored, like Ozymandias, Night Owl, and, you know, so you get this really, and by the way, don't get Sharon started on the way Alan Moore depicts women, because the character of Silk Spectre and Silk Spectre 2, mother and daughter, she said flat out, Alan Moore can't write for women, or he hates women, one or the other. It's hard to tell which. So anyway, the characters are tackling issues that are more adult in nature, but I think you can argue whether they are really being dealt with on a more complex level, because some of their motivations seem a little cardboard. But again, that's a topic for another issue. And maybe you've answered my question already, that kids are not the primary targets of these, at least in the graphic novel form anymore. But, you know, again, part and parcel of this, and the reason we keep bringing up the movies, is that a lot of graphic novels are being – some of them are going straight to video now. They're not even being published. Graphic novels, and it's brilliant when you think about it, are really nothing more than ready-made storyboards for the filmmaker.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there's – You can almost tell when you see a trailer for a movie whether it was originally a graphic novel because it has a look to it, a feel to it.
Well, and I think the other thing is there's just so much material now. You know, Marvel and DC have been putting out comics for how long? You know, 50, 100 years. Mm-hmm. Well, not 100, but it's close.
About
you
75,
know,
probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, since the
30s. They've got huge runs of these stories with Batman and Superman and even some of the lesser known characters. And the other thing is they're realizing a lot of the producers of comic books are realizing a couple things. One, people who buy regular issue comic books are kind of on the decline, especially with the economy now. But and I've been through this myself. More often than not, if you pick up every issue, about every 5 issues for most books, not so much with Marvel and DC, they're a little longer before you'll see a graphic novel, but with companies like Image, every 5 to 10 issues, they'll release a graphic novel or a trade paperback, as they're now called, because as I found out this week when I was talking to one of the guys at the comic book store, graphic novel apparently implies something to parents about the nature of what's in the novel. So now they want to call them trade paperbacks.
Gotcha.
And to be honest, many of them are very graphic. but, you know, there's a decline to some degree in people who buy every issue every week when you can come in every 6 months and pick up all 10 in a nicer format.
Okay.
So, you know, trade paperbacks are more popular in some respects. Not every book provider or every publisher does that, you know, and there are still a lot of smaller publishers out there. And, you know, Marvel and DC tend to do it more along, at least in the past, they've done it more along storylines. So, you know, back in the 80s, you had a bunch of X-Men graphic novels that came out, most of which were either collected right out of story arcs within the comic as a whole. They didn't just, you know, you didn't usually get like, well, this is issue X to X, which seems to be more the case now. Oh, you know, one of the comics I read is written by Robert Kirkman. And what is it? Which one am I talking about? Thinking about here. Astounding Wolfman, I believe, where basically a guy gets bitten by a werewolf and becomes a superhero. He chooses to use his powers for good, even though he's being mentored by a vampire, and his life goes to hell because of the curse slash gift he's just been given. I was picking it up in issues, thought it was really good. After the 5th issue came out, the next month, out on the newsstands, was the first graphic novel, as it were, or trade paper of those issues. So that's, you've got that factor. The other thing is, these aren't cheap, and, you know, if you're... if you aren't making a decent living, you aren't going to be easily picking up, you know, $25, $30 worth of books every week, mm-hmm. plus graphic novels when they come out. I think the primary audience for a lot of this stuff is more the comic book geeks who grew up with it and the new wave of comic book fans who have come, who are coming, coming of age to where they can afford to do this. But I don't think you're seeing as many kids because I think partly the availability is harder. You don't see it in the stores like when you and I grew up. You go to the convenience store and pick up a comic book, and partly because there's more distraction. So in the roundabout way, what I'm trying to say is I think that the publishers are realizing that this market is shrinking in terms of the actual books. Plus, there's pressure to stop printing as much paper and everything else because of, you know, environmental movement and everything else. So they're moving more towards what can we do to take these characters to the media or to another form of media. You know, we saw the Smallville series. We've seen Lois and Clark. We've seen more television come around with superhero themes.
Well, Heroes. You know, in fact, Heroes. Sharon commented while we were watching the motion comic of Watchmen that Heroes seemed to be really an echo of Watchmen. Although you did have the characters with superhuman abilities, a lot of the themes seemed to be repeating themselves.
Oh yeah, I would agree. I think that's the why everybody credits Watchmen with all this great power is it did have such it really changed the way a lot of writers looked at comic books. A lot of people up till then really took a more shallow, even the best writers took a more shallow view when they were writing like superhero comics.
Villain of the week.
Right, you know, it was, oh, villain of the week, or, well, we might have an arc, but it's still, you know, it's pretty shallow in how we deal with these things. Yeah, there had been some attempts to do more serious stuff, but nobody really pulled it off until Alan Moore kind of brought the Watchmen to bear. People had tried it, and some of the independents had even tried it, and you saw some really good books come out of that. But none of them really stuck like Watchmen. Part of that, I would also say, is yes, it was a very good book, but I also remember DC marketed the hell out of it. They made a big deal out of this book coming out and out of Alan Moore. Because at the time, Alan Moore had, I believe it, I can't remember the exact timing, but I think Constantine was after that, but he had done Swamp Thing. Mm-hmm. And Swamp Thing, he took a comic that was in essence dead. And brought it back to life. Swamp Thing would have died out if it wasn't for somebody of Alan Moore's caliber coming in and writing a book or writing it. Mm-hmm. You know, well, then again, Swamp Thing was never the most brilliant of comics anyway, because it's this weird swamp monster thing that fights stuff, you know.
But with the right spin, especially now with the environmental movement being as strong as it is, it's very timely. So I would not be surprised to see another Swamp Thing film here before too much longer, with, of course, the requisite global climate change warming theme as its premise.
Right.
So the influence of the comics themselves among younger readers, not what it was, but the influence on the culture at large is what?
I would think it's still pretty big. I mean, as we see that, one, we're seeing a decline in reading in general. You know, people read less books. They watch more TV. They go to movies more. As you said, comic books are much easier to convert to a movie. If you're using an existing script, you already have almost a complete storyboard figured out. You just have to fit the movie things into it. You know, obviously some things work in drawn form that don't work in movies. And in a lot of cases, you have good writing from the perspective of something that will work for a movie. I've talked to comic book writers at various points, although I've never actually interviewed one for any period of time or any length on my show. I should do that if I can get somebody. Mm-hmm. But a lot of how they write is very similar to how you would write for a movie. You know, you describe the scene, you put the dialogue in, kind of say what's going to happen, and then you hand it to the artist and they make it happen. Mm-hmm. You know, very similar. So you've got a ton of scripts that are available as well to do this.
Yeah. And looking ahead, there's an article at denofgeek.com, which is a website that Sharon turned me on to, which is wonderful. listing all of the upcoming movies that are being developed from comics and graphic novels. And the list is very, very long.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, beyond the obvious ones, like the three X-Men spinoffs that are coming up and Batman 3 or Dark Knight 3, which is coming up, Spider-Man 4, you've also got Flash Gordon, which is being redone, Doctor Strange, G.I. Joe, Gambit, which is another one of the – is Gambit one of the X-Men?
He wasn't one of the original, but yes, he came along later.
That's what I thought. Green Lantern.
Yep.
Iron Man 2, of course. Judge Dredd is going to be redone. The Sylvester Stallone original was kind of an embarrassment.
Yeah.
Namor the Submariner. Nick Fury. Of course, he was hinted at in the last Iron Man with Samuel Jackson.
For the Marvel titles, though, they're doing all the characters that are part of the Avengers because they're building for the Avengers film. Sure. And the Nick Fury is part of that because he's part of the whole Avengers thing.
And, you know, Sergeant Rock from DC. You've got a Sherlock Holmes film that's being developed from a graphic novel that was never published. And this is one of the examples I was talking about, how the graphic novel is being used as a spec script. Silver Surfer, Sin City 2, Sin City 3, Superman, Man of Steel. Captain America is going to be turned into a movie. The Flash, The Green Hornet. The Shadow is going to be redone, which is good because the original Shadow.
The other one was terrible.
I liked Alec Baldwin okay, but just not in that movie. Thor and a variety of others. There are also a couple of, again, supernatural-themed graphic novels that will be turned into movies. One called War in Heaven, which is being spun as The Next 300. And you can bet that will, despite the theological overtones there, not be a Christian film in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
There's another one called Preacher, in which a Texas preacher who's possessed by a supernatural entity hits the road to make God accountable for abandoning his duties in heaven.
Well,
you know something about this one, huh?
I've read the first two parts of Preacher.
Okay.
It's written by Garth Ennis, who has a problem with religion.
Sure.
Although, if you read his books, I've read some of Wormwood. I've actually read a lot of Garth Ennis because he's a really good writer. Preacher is an interesting story, and it actually starts out being somewhat orthodox to biblical theology and then goes astray pretty fast. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that it's God, you know, has gone off to do his own thing. He left the angels in charge. Angel and a fallen angel get together, have a child. The child is locked up because he's dangerous. It's not like we haven't seen this theme in other places. He gets released, and the preacher in question, the main character whose name eludes me at this point, is possessed by that creature. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, in essence, he's on a mission to find God and hold him accountable.
So watch for that coming soon to a theater near you. Also, of course, we got the other, one Nicolas Cage starred in Ghost Rider.
Oh, not another one, please.
Well, no, I don't think there's another one coming, but that was one that was recently out there with a supernatural theme to it, in which, again, human intervention is required to set right something on the supernatural plane, which is just not the way it works.
Right. Well, but that's the humanism coming back into this, you know. Ultimately, all of these, at least the mainstream superhero stories are going to be humanistic. Man has to intervene for anything to happen. If there is a God, he's just sitting in the background, you know. He wound up the watch. He threw it out there. At best, you've got a deistic point of view. Mm-hmm. You know,
disinterested watchmaker, which again is sort of the point of view presented by the character Dr. Manhattan in Watchmen.
Right.
Whose father, interestingly, was a watchmaker.
Right.
So you've got the symbolism there. The watchmaker, through his nuclear accident, Dr. Manhattan becomes the watchmaker and just stands by and watches as humanity first prepares to destroy itself through nuclear holocaust, and then allows Ozymandias to wipe out half of New York City, killing about 4 million people, in order to save, you know, the 4 billion across the planet.
Right.
The God that we know of through the Bible does allow human free will and freedom of choice, of course, but with consequences, and with the ultimate knowledge and surety that God does have a plan for the end game, And it does not depend on our actions to facilitate, expedite, or frustrate his ultimate design.
Right.
So, I guess in a nutshell, it shouldn't be that surprising that comics present that kind of a humanistic worldview because, again, we're living in a world in which the enemy has control.
Right.
And doesn't really care what we believe as long as it's not in the way.
As long as we don't believe Jesus is who he said he was, mm-hmm. and we have accepted the sacrifice he's made, the enemy has won. It doesn't matter what we do, what we say, how good a person we are. If we don't believe that and we don't accept Christ as our Savior, the enemy's won. Game over.
Yeah.
You know?
What?
And go ahead.
In the people that you know in the industry and those you know in the larger fan community, how many do you encounter who have made that decision?
You know, it's kind of hard to say, and I say that not as a cop out, but because a lot, I think it's the culture we're in really forces people to take this kind of dualistic view with their faith. When I'm out in the world, when I'm doing these things, you know, I may be a Christian, but I'm going to hide it. Very rarely do I run into people. Who say things to the effect, you know, say things like, I didn't read that because I thought it would conflict with, my view of the Bible or something like that. I actually think based on going to some of these conventions and talking to a lot of these people, there are a lot more people who at least believe they're Christians than you would think.
Now, that's interesting. How many of them really think about the message that they're, I don't know if absorbing is the right word, the message they're exposed to through the humanistic perspective in most mainstream comics and how that relates to their own Christian walk?
I would say it's probably closer to the minority who actually put two and two together and don't just see it as entertainment. You know, most of us who grew up, at least when I went to school, weren't really taught effectively how to critically think. You know, we were brand school in the 70s and 80s when I was going to it was more of the product of the 60s education movements and stuff, and it was really focused more on, well, I hate to say it, but brainwashing to a lot of degree. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as bad as it is now. But I think that a lot of people I've talked to and a lot of smart people I've talked to who've been to college, et cetera, look at this stuff and they almost take the point of view that it has no influence on me. What I read is nothing. You know, it has no effect on how I view the real world or anything else. And I think that's totally wrong. Mm-hmm. But I think there are a lot of people out there and I, you know, I've caught myself doing the same thing who totally disregard the material that's there. They look at it and, you know, they read the story and they think, oh, well, that's a great story. And they never put two and two together with what they believe. And I think the minority, which, you know, I can name maybe five or six people, you being one of them, who actually puts effort into saying, well, I read that, but I didn't really agree with it. Or I started to read that and I hit something that was so totally messed up that I really didn't want to deal with or didn't want to taint my worldview that I just stopped looking at it, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's one of the things that jumped out at me about the Da Vinci Code, just mm-hmm. the gross errors in history, you know, regarding the Emperor Constantine and the Council of Nicaea.
Right.
I mean, that basically was a wall I couldn't get around in Da Vinci Code. I read the rest of it just to see what the big deal was about, but
right.
That was, you know, that kind of ruined it for me. But again, watching things, whether they've got a theological slant like Constantine,
right,
or a humanistic slant like Watchmen or Sin City, in which
right.
if theological characters, religious characters are presented at all, they are evil.
Right. Well, yeah, V for Vendetta gives us a better view of that.
Right, exactly.
Right.
it does send up a red flag. And the fact that people are more likely to accept something that they read as fiction into their worldview than something mm-hmm. they read as nonfiction is, again, part of the reason I wanted to have this conversation with you, Taylor, because our kids are, frankly, exposed to the culture far more than they are exposed to the gospel.
Right.
Our kids absorb more television, more video games, and there's an awful lot of theology being thrown at them in video games mm-hmm. under the you know, cover of entertainment than we recognize as parents. A lot of Gnostic stuff in even
right.
the Adventures of Zelda, which was a pretty harmless game by comparison to most.
Right.
And people will absorb that far more readily than if they are to sit down and try to read their way through the Bible or commentaries on the Bible. Because right. for some reason, when you see something as fiction, your onboard BS detector is shut off.
Right.
And to be perfectly honest, that's why Sharon and I write fiction, based on what we believe, figuring, yay, the enemy's doing it. You know, maybe we can present our worldview in the same form and get some people get some people without their even realizing it through the form of a good story. But I
agree with you.
Yeah, that is the way of the world. You know, we will be, and Sharon will happily tell you that when we met, which was just about, you know, 12 years ago, 11, 12 years ago, I subscribed to this you know, supernatural cosmic watchmaker theory. You know, there is a God out there who sort of stands off in the distance and just lets us do our own thing without intervention. You know, a higher power, this amorphous higher power,
right,
who sort of set things in motion and stands back. I no longer believe that. I reject that completely. But at the time, and this Watchmen film and graphic novel got me to thinking, how much of what I absorbed did I really, of my worldview, really came from Silver Surfer or Thor?
Right.
And probably more than I realized. And I won't know for sure until, you know, if I should ever go back and reread those books. But I suspect that it's a lot more than I realized.
Well, and I would agree. I mean, it's you're being exposed at an early age, which is less and less so. Mm-hmm. But now kids are being exposed to things like, you know, Grand Theft Auto at an early age,
right,
even though they,
right,
quote, shouldn't be because it's got a mature rating. Yeah, that's going to stop them. I mean, we all know that the rating system is nothing more than a marketing scheme to get kids to want to play something. Mm-hmm. Just like R-rated movies make more money than PG and PG-13 rated movies because more teenagers want to go see them. And I think that part of, you know, the other thing that, you know, as comics now, we're seeing more and more extremes in comics. And I think that's just the nature of our new, you know, there are more and more extremes in everything. Mm-hmm. There are still good, you know, and I don't want to paint like all comics are bad or none of them have a Christian point of view or anything like that, because there are good comics out there that treat faith well or that even have it as a center point. You've got the Archangel books out there. Mm-hmm. You've got Pistol Fist that was done by Blue Water, Blue Ocean, or somebody like that, that is set in the Revolutionary War with a superhero who's a Christian. Although Ben Franklin plays fairly centrally in that book. And you've got, you know, there is stuff out there. I don't, you know, it's hard because the other thing with comics is there's just so much. It's hard to wade through and find these things. Mm-hmm. And there are different sites that talk about them and that, but it's still hard to say, oh, well, this is you know, there's no guide per se that catches everything.
We'll have to work on that. And we'll see if we can't put together some links here for the show notes at pidradio.com. Because as a writer and as a fan of comic books as a youth and as somebody who enjoys watching good movies,
right,
when you think about the palette that you have to work with in the Bible and consider the range of characters that you have to draw from and the cosmology that's developed in the Bible, where you've got fallen angels, you've got dragons, you've got wizards, you've got demons,
giants.
Giants. What more do you need to create a good story? But, of course, once it's put through the machinations of Hollywood or the comic publishing industry, It's not going right. to come out with a Christian worldview on it because, as desperately as Americans would like to believe that we live in a country that trusts in God, Satan made very clear when he tempted Jesus in the desert that all kingdoms yep. are his. They've been given to him, and he gives them to who he will. So, you know, we're behind enemy lines.
Yep,
and we should
exactly.
not expect that anything that comes out from the mainstream, with very rare exception, is going to present a message, a gospel message, or something that's at least consistent with the gospel. And as parents, and even as adults, reading mm-hmm. and taking in entertainment, we just need to be aware of what it is we believe, why we believe it, and whether what we are reading or seeing is in accordance with those beliefs.
Right. I agree completely. You have to be discerning about what you're doing, you know. We all, you know, that's not to say you're not going to make a mistake in that either. Sure, we've all been lured in by some of these things too, you know, but put some time into looking at what you watch, what you read, and what you believe. And, well, you should start with what you believe. As we know, most people really don't have a strong sense of what they believe who are Christians, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you don't have that, you're never going to be that effective in discerning anything else.
Right. And believe me, I'm not saying that we should stay away from films or music with guitars in
right.
it because that's evil. No, I don't think so.
Right.
And I've got friends who do believe that, and that's fine. I think the Apostle Paul made it clear that you need to discern for yourself and act in accordance with your beliefs as long as you're
right.
not causing anyone else to stumble. So.
Right.
My whole point, and I guess the thing that I just really felt led this week, Taylor, and I'm glad you were available today to take this on, even though I feel like I've kind of rambled a bit here.
That's all right.
I just feel like, you know, the culture out there, we're just kind of soaking in a cesspool of propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be discerning enough as Christians to see it for ourselves, because if we can't see it for ourselves, we're certainly not going to be able to explain it to our kids. Who are
right.
far more susceptible to the message than we are as adults.
Right. I agree.
Now, don't want to let you get away before we give you an opportunity to plug what you're doing, because you are putting in a lot of time and a lot of effort really behind enemy lines in the fan community and making contacts and showing those who are seeking and in these communities that Christians can be you know, rational about the discussions rather than simply mm-hmm. dogmatic or ideologues. And to that end, you are doing some real outreach stuff through your podcast and through your other online stuff. So go ahead and plug, you know, the snark infested waters, Saturday night in the snark cave, all the fun stuff you're doing online.
You know, you make it sound so much cooler than it really is sometimes.
You are a cool dude.
I hate to sound like I have a bunch of doubts or anything, but, you know, of late, and I'm not saying don't listen to my show or anything, but I've really wondered how much impact I'm having in that respect. You know, I've been really open about what I am and what I believe, you know, and that's not going to change. But I really wonder in our current climate how much good that's doing. But hey, you know, God's taking care of that, and I'm not going to. So, in essence, I am doing three different shows, soon to be four. The first and original show is Snark Infested Waters, which is now recorded live on Thursday nights at 7:30 Central Time. No, 8:30 Central Time on Ustream. And it the original moniker was Where Faith, Art, and Fandom Collide, and, well, more or less, that's what it is still. We do a lot of movie reviews and talking about kind of pop culture-y things. We've lately talked a little more on politics and the economy and some of that kind of stuff, too. Saturday Night in the Snark Cave, which is the one of two new shows that's come up, is a live, basically making fun of or riffing of the movie on Sci-Fi Channel's most dangerous or disappointing night of television. And that is at 8 p.m. Central Time. That's also on Ustream. If you go over to thesnarkyavenger.com, you can find links to the actual live shows. And that is purely a live show. We were recording it early on, but I've decided that we're just going to stick to it being live. Would love to have people come out for it. I think it's a lot of fun. I know Derek's been there for a few of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm hoping to get Derek on as a co-host at one of these points. So,
be happy to do that. Happy to do it. These movies deserve to be mocked.
Yes. Then I've brought back Snark Tank Radio, which is kind of my snarky music show. I'm trying some new things with that. That started last week. You can get that at thesnarkyavenger.com. And in the summer, I will be starting to put out The Adventures of the Snarky Avenger, which is going to be short stories written by me about the Snarky Avenger. It'll probably start out. I did one at Christmas. If you go back to December 24th, I released it on Christmas Eve. I did The Snarky Avenger Gets to Escort Santa Around the World for his rounds. And that's out there, and that's kind of the start of it. And then I'm hoping this summer we can really get that going as a monthly deal, put out a new short story every month of just crazy, wild adventures. And The Adventure of the Snarky Avenger are more or less kind of this wild pulp, crazy kind of far-fetched fiction in the Robert Rankin sense of the word, worldview with superheroes and supervillains and a high comedy element. And it's just a lot of fun, and I think everybody's going to enjoy it.
And having done some audio recording myself for Iron Dragons, I know that takes a lot of time. So
yes.
Appreciate the amount of time and work you're putting into not just writing it, but then having to perform it, record it, edit it, and get the production out there. So it's something you're putting a lot of time and effort into.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's always fun to talk with you, and especially to talk about these things, kind of scratch the comic itch that I guess I put aside by the time I got to my science fiction novel reading years.
Right.
There's enough of it back there to kind of remember what it was about. And again, just thinking about the influence that I think it had on me, and looking at the massive marketing push that went into Watchmen and other graphic novels turned into movies like, of course, the obvious ones, the Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, Hulk.
Yep.
But then the others like Sin City.
Yep.
And the messages that are being presented out there to the culture at large, and especially to kids who aren't as discerning. They don't have the filters that we cynical adults have put on.
Right.
I think it's just good, if no other reason, just to remind people that you need to be discerning of what's going through your filters. And please, you know, talk with your kids about this stuff.
Yes.
Before they wind up developing their theology through graphic novels. Sadly, and I'll just toss this out as just kind of a quick one-off comment, there are an awful lot of Christians who develop their theology from the fiction aisle at the bookstore as well.
Yes,
so,
I would agree.
Yeah, we need to make sure that we're aware of that fact and cognizant of that as well. Taylor Kent, The Snarky Avenger, thesnarkyavenger.com. Taylor, always a pleasure, and look forward to seeing you again sometime.
Yes, I do too.
Any chance that you'll get down for MoCon this year? Or is that
probably not. Money and time are just not aligning themselves for that to happen.
Well, good thing that there are such things as webcams and Skype and so forth. So
yes.
I'll check in with you again soon. All the notes regarding the discussion today and selected links will be posted at pidradio.com. Sharon, once again, continuing to work on the website, so you'll see new and improved websites at DerekPGilbert.com and SharonKGilbert.com, so check those out as well. And until next time, I'm Derek Gilbert. Thanks for listening.
On demand.
This is PID Radio.